Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
I'm Kimberly Akinstor, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. On this day, 50 years ago, June 23rd, 1972, an amendment was signed into law that held a promise to change women's lives forever.
Our goal was to see that our daughters would have the same opportunities as our sons.
That's then-Senator Birch Bayh from Indiana, described as the father of Title IX, an amendment tacked onto the 1964 Civil Rights Act banning gender discrimination at all schools receiving federal funds. It was just one sentence, a mere 37 words, but it gave thousands of women in the U.S. more opportunities from the classroom to the playing fields. For Representative Patsy Mink of Hawaii, it marked a cultural shift in America.
And so long as any part of our society adheres to a sexist notion that men should do certain things and women should do certain things, and then begin to inculcate our babies with these notions through curriculum development and so forth, then we'll never be rid of the basic causes of sex discrimination.
Before Title IX, roughly 294,000 girls were playing high school sports. The number for boys? 3.7 million. Today, that gap has shrunk significantly, with more than 3.4 million girls participating in high school sports. That's about a million fewer than the number of boys. Meanwhile, at the collegiate level, 30,000 women played college sports in 1971, whereas today, it's more than 219,000. But these numbers don't tell the full story. Just because there's an equity law doesn't mean there's the equity there should be. Amy Cohen was a gymnast at Brown University, class of 1992. She excelled. Her team won the Ivy League title for the first time, and she was elected co-captain her senior year. Things were going really well, until they weren't.
It was a nice spring weekend. We were outside, and some other athletes came up to me and said, "I don't know if you heard that they're cutting the gymnastics team." I couldn't believe it. But sure enough, the next day, the athletic director called our team over, and we had a meeting with him, and he told us that they had asked him to make some budget cuts, and the way that he was choosing to do that was by eliminating four of the varsity teams, gymnastics included.
Besides women's gymnastics, the women's volleyball and men's golf and water polo teams were also cut, but the number of women impacted was larger than the number of men.
So right away, we looked at, you know, what else could we do? And that's how we came across our understanding of Title IX. We started to learn about Title IX. It was not anything I'd ever heard of. It was not anything anyone had ever taught me about, even though it had already been around for, you know, quite a long time. The more we looked into it, the more we learned, the more we believed that Brown was in violation of Title IX, and the more we believed that this was maybe an issue bigger than just our gymnastics team.
So they called up a lawyer and decided to do the unthinkable, sue the very university they were attending.
So we went, you know, moving forward with the lawsuit, really believing that it was just going to be a threat and that that would be the best way to get our team back. We were surprised when Brown said, "Absolutely not. We are leaders in women's sports. And if we're in violation, everyone in the country is in violation. And go ahead, take us to court." We felt that we were doing the right thing, but I think we were not met with much support or positive reaction. There was the fear from other athletes, other female athletes, that if it wasn't our team, it would be their team. There was the fear from some big men's sports like football that it would negatively impact their budgets because that money to fund the women would have to come from their budgets. There was the fear from smaller...
It took 6 years, but Brown University finally settled. In 1998, it agreed to offer athletic opportunities to women roughly proportionate to their enrollment and restored the women's gymnastics and volleyball teams.
It felt like a huge win because most of the schools around the country were not complying with Title IX. And I think that made an impact that we never imagined, but we really embraced. And we really were so happy to see that schools around the country really started to look at their programs and say, wow, we are out of violation. And I think a lot of schools around the country did start to make positive changes.
For more than 20 years, Cohen versus Brown has stood as the landmark case in upholding Title IX. In May 2020, Anna Susini was a rising junior at Brown, just elected co-captain of the fencing team, when she received an impromptu email from the athletics department to join a Zoom call within the hour.
And it was Jack Hayes, who was the director of athletics, who basically announced, "We're cutting these sports." I don't really remember what he said after that because everyone was freaking out and texting me, and I was texting my coach, and I remember texting my co-captain and asking him, like, "Did we just get cut? Is that what just happened?" And he was like, "Yeah, that is what just happened." And the whole thing was really unbelievable.
In total, the university cut 11 teams, men's and women's fencing, golf, and squash, as well as women's skiing, women's equestrian, men's track and field, and cross country. Brown said its varsity teams were underperforming, and it wanted to streamline the number of teams to enable them to be more competitive. Right away, the student athletes started organizing to figure out what they could do to save their teams.
The turning point was really a couple weeks later when the men's track team got reinstated because they had sort of launched their own PR campaign, and that had gained a lot of ground very quickly for that sport specifically. And then that was what threw the Title IX numbers way out of balance.
So Anna Susini, along with several other student athletes at Brown, took the university to court. Among those deposed were Brown University President Christina Paxson. She was asked to read an email recently sent to her by Brown Chancellor Samuel Menkoff about that original 1998 Title IX settlement.
"But here's an idea. Could we use this moment where anger and frustration, especially from track and squash, are intense in building, to go after the consent decree once and for all? Could we channel all this emotion away from anger at Brown to anger at the court and kill this pestilent thing?"
Paxson replied, quote, "I think it's a good idea."
It felt like something that you read about, like some other school, like, "Oh, this thing came out and the chancellor said this and the president said that. And can you believe it? Isn't that insane?" And I couldn't really believe that it was my school. It was this place that I'd held in such high regard for so long. I think it was very disorienting. And I was happy because of what it meant for our case, but it was also really sad to think that that's how our administrators see an issue as important as gender equity.
A month after Paxson's deposition, the university settled and agreed to restore the women's fencing and equestrian teams. In a written statement, Brown President Christina Paxson stated, quote, "We are very pleased with the settlement. We can provide excellent athletics opportunities for women and men, be a leader in upholding Title IX, and have a competitive varsity program, and we will." As part of that settlement, starting in 2024, Brown University will be released from its agreement in Cohen versus Brown to keep athletic opportunities for women within a set percentage of their enrollment. Brown University is not the only school that cut men's and women's athletics teams during the pandemic. From March to November 2020, 352 teams across the three NCAA divisions were eliminated, suspended, or closed. These eliminations represent the most program cuts in NCAA history. history in such a time period. Several of those schools have also been sued for violating Title IX, such as William & Mary, Dartmouth, the University of Iowa, Clemson, just to name a few. So on this 50th anniversary of Title IX, we're going to focus on why the amendment has yet to live up to its original promise for women in college sports and what can be done to fix that. Joining us now is Donna Lopiano. She's the former CEO of the Women's Sports Foundation, where she served for 15 years. She's also a 9-time All-American softball player and member of the National Sports Hall of Fame. Donna is joining us from Sheldon, Connecticut. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Kimberly.
So I want to say we are aware that Title IX covers far more than sports. It's a very broad amendment that is meant to address a lot of things. But just for this show, we are focusing on the sports aspect. And listening to that open, the way that Amy Cohen was told by Brown, you know, if we're not in compliance, then no one is. Do you think that that actually is true? How wide do you think non-compliance with Title IX really is?
Well, there's no question that probably 90% of all high schools and colleges in the United States are not in full compliance with Title IX's gender equity requirements. And the reason for that is that there is no policeman at the or police force that's looking at Title IX compliance. The Department of Education Office of Civil Rights does not have the resources, either monetary or human energy to police 2,000 intercollegiate athletic programs and over 20,000 high school programs. What's missing from this picture, what has resulted in 50 years of trying and not reaching Title IX, is that we really should add to the amendment provision that in order to receive federal funds, that you must be a member of an athletic governance organization, either the State High School Association or the NCAA, that requires you to comply with Title IX in terms of gender equity, or you cannot access a state high school championship competition or a national championship competition that your athletic teams can't play.
And so right
kind of
now,
incentive
the onus
isn't there.
Right now, the onus is on the students, right? The only way to force compliance is through a lawsuit being brought by students, essentially.
Yeah, and it's a very poor mechanism because students are afraid to sue their own schools. They're afraid of retaliation. They're afraid of losing a starting position. They're afraid of losing their scholarships. Parents don't want to stir that pot and endanger their children.
Yeah.
And that's why you see... lawsuits only when teams are dropped.
So I want to pause
when a
right
team
there.
Is dropped, there's nothing on this
50th anniversary, we're discussing Title IX and focusing on women in collegiate sports and explaining how we could live up to its original promise, how Title IX can live up to its promise. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. On this, its 50th anniversary, we're discussing Title IX with a focus on women in collegiate sports and exploring how the amendment can be better enforced to live up to its original promise. We're joined by Donna Lopiano. She's the former CEO of the Women's Sports Foundation, where she served for 15 years, and also a 9-time All-American softball player and a member of the National Sports Hall of Fame. I also want to introduce to the show Lori Bullock. She's a Title IX attorney and is joining us from Ames, Iowa. Lori, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Kimberly. It's great to be here.
So, Lori, you heard Donna estimate that as much as 90% of schools are out of compliance with Title IX. What exactly does it mean to be out of compliance? There's a three-prong test, right?
Yes, that's correct. So in terms of, out of compliance, for the most part, what we're talking about is out of compliance with participation opportunities. And what Title IX requires is that, there's three ways that colleges or universities can comply. They can offer substantially proportionate opportunities to their male and female student athletes, which just basically means that if they're undergrad student population is 60% women, then their female student athletes need to also represent 60% of the program. The second way is that the university can demonstrate a continued history of program expansion for women. And the third is the university can demonstrate that although it's not providing substantially proportionate opportunities, it is meeting all of the interest and ability of the female students at its institution.
And Lori, how many schools roughly have you sued for being in violation of Title IX?
In the past few years, as you heard earlier, many schools eliminated teams during the pandemic. I personally have sued or threatened lawsuits against 15 universities in the past couple of years. There are many other lawsuits going on around the country as well with additional Title IX attorneys.
And what are some of the things that have stood out from these cases that you've uncovered in terms of what these schools are doing to undercut Title IX?
One of the most shocking things that you uncover as an attorney coming into these cases is first and foremost, when a team is cut and we start looking into further Title IX compliance, whether or not the school is offering proportionate athletic financial aid to its male and female students, and whether or not they're treating their male and female student athletes the same or equally, almost all schools are also out of compliance with Title IX in those ways as well. The other thing that you discover when you come in and start really digging into the data is that, I think every school that I have sued has initiated the conversation with, we believe we're in compliance with Title IX. When you dig into the participation data, there are many ways that schools are fudging their numbers, padding their numbers to make it appear that they are in compliance with Title IX when in fact they are not.
And Donna, what sort of things have you seen schools say when confronted with challenges, claims that they are not living up to Title IX's requirements? What defenses have you heard from schools that are accused of this?
Well, it used to be early on in Title IX that the defense was that women aren't interested in playing sports, but it's really important for the public to understand, and I can attest to this having been an administrator for 50 years, that if you start an athletic team and you hire a coach, that no coach has ever come back to their boss and said, I couldn't find any girls interested in playing. So what determines opportunities for girls is the decision of the institution to add a team. So in speaking with in responding to Lori's comment, when she talks about fudging numbers, what schools try to do is add a team, let's say add a rowing team, and instead of a rowing team having 45 players, they'll tell the coach, oh, you have to have 65 players. And they'll inflate teams and not give all girls the same opportunities as boys. Those extra 20 or 25 opportunities are almost ghost opportunities.
Yeah. And Donna, what do you say to schools when they say, look, we're cutting teams for you know, throughout the pandemic for economic reasons, and we're cutting men's teams too. We're not focused on women's teams. What do you say to that?
And therein lies the heart of the problem. If 90% of the schools are already out of compliance with Title IX, and then they say, oh, we're cutting teams equally, the starting point for that cut is women are already behind the eight ball. Male athletes are already advantaged, and the cuts are putting women further behind, and not really substantial cuts for men.
Yeah. So, Lori, I want to talk a little bit more about what you talked about fudging numbers, schools fudging numbers, trying to inflate the number of the participation numbers from women. Can you talk a little bit more specifically about that? What sort of things have you seen schools do?
I've seen schools, you know, the Equity in Athletics Disclosure Act allows schools to report male practice players as female student athletes, and schools will allow, you know, males who are not, typically this happens on the basketball teams, but men who are not quite capable of playing and on the men's basketball team yet, underclassmen, will practice with the women and then be counted as participants on the women's team. And like Donna talked about, you know, one of the biggest areas that we see universities padding their rosters is through rowing programs. And, you know, Donna talked about having 65. There are many universities in the country where the rowing program that they, you know, starts out at 80 or 90 women. And some of those women will never see the inside of a boat. Many of those women have never rowed before and get into the sport for a week or two, decide that it's not for them. It's not what they want to be dedicating their time in college to, because make no mistake, being a college athlete is a huge time commitment and a huge energy commitment on behalf of these students. And they'll make the decision that, you know, the women don't want to participate in rowing. They'll quit the team within the first couple weeks of the semester. And the university will continue reporting those women who quit as Title IX participants. So by the time they get to the actual competition season in the spring, there will be 50 to 40, 45 to 50 women, but the school is still reporting 80 to 90 women, even though those women don't compete.
And we talked a little bit about enforcement, Donna. The U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights is tasked with enforcing Title IX in elementary schools and secondary schools. But when we reached out for comment about their role, this is part of the response that we got from OCR. They said, unfortunately, a significant challenge is staff capacity. OCR's overall staffing level has declined significantly over the last few decades, even as the volume of complaints received has grown exponentially. OCR is very grateful that the president has requested a $26 million increase in funding for OCR in his proposed budget. Donna, do you think that this is a staffing issue at OCR?
As I said before, I don't think it needs to be a staffing issue. If the government were to pass a simple incentive rule, as I first described, requiring that athletic governance organizations have as a condition of membership and a condition of access to postseason play, that schools be in compliance with Title IX and that they be regularly assessed by an outside third party, usually a conference office, we would solve that problem because we know that when boys' opportunities for postseason play are threatened, schools will act quickly to protect that opportunity, even though they have not done so for women.
So, Lori, it's not just the matter of the number of teams available, the number of players that are given opportunities, but also conditions when it comes to the difference between men's and women's team. Can you talk about that and some things that you've seen when it comes to the differences in conditions?
Absolutely. When I first meet with student athletes, like Donna said, you know, most of the time these are women whose sport has been eliminated. They have nothing left to lose. And so they're finally at the point where they're ready to initiate a lawsuit against their university. We always talk about, well, what are some of the things that men's teams get that the women's teams do not? And it's a little heartbreaking because initiating those conversations, a lot of the women express that, well, they're just really happy to play. They don't want to rock the boat. You know, the fact that the men's basketball team flies to every game via a charter plane and they're traveling 10 hours one way on a bus isn't something that they want to challenge if it means they don't get to play their sport. But I've seen everything from, you know, the men's football team at Clemson University was receiving two custom suits, custom tailored suits for away games. Meanwhile, when I asked the female students, you know, what would you like in terms of apparel? What do you feel like you're not getting? One of the student athletes said, well, it'd be really great if we could get more than one sports bra provided to us so we didn't have to wash it as much. And wow, the disparities can just be shocking, really. You know, I've seen women's teams playing and practicing on high school or middle school facilities while the men's teams have state-of-the-art, you know, constantly renovated and updated facilities. I've seen photos and personally been in locker rooms that are run down and poorly maintained for the women's teams, while, you know, the men's football teams, men's basketball team lockers look like something straight out of the professionals.
Yeah. And also, Donna, talk about the gap when it comes to scholarship availability. There certainly is a disparity there as well, right?
Absolutely. The estimates are at the college level that women are being shortchanged $1 billion a year. Mm. That's $1 billion a year. That buys a lot of education. And that's a function. If you're not meeting your participation requirements under Title IX, and your percentage of female athletes is artificially low and is discriminatory, then when it comes to distributing athletic scholarships proportional to athletic participation, the women lose. And that's exactly what's happening on a regular basis at most institutions.
And Lori, that we're also talking about recruitment. I mean, things like scholarships and recruitment funding are crucial to get students this opportunity to participate in sports. So this isn't just happening once they get to the schools. This is happening long before. Talk a little bit about the gap in recruitment that you've seen.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, almost every university is providing significantly, oftentimes it's almost double. The men receive almost double the recruiting budget that the women's teams are allotted. And this directly affects how far coaches are able to travel to recruit players, how many players they can have on campus for recruiting trips, and what they can provide to them. You know, the men's teams are given seemingly unlimited resources. And when the universities are challenged on this disparity in recruitment dollars, the most common excuse that I hear is that it just costs more to recruit for some sports, like football. But the reality is that it costs the same amount to bring a young girl on campus to wow her and show her around and demonstrate to her exactly what she could receive by coming to the college and how she could benefit as it does a male. It's just where the university's priorities are.
So, Donna, I want to ask you, in your time in this field, have you seen improvements? I mean, we're painting a very dire picture here, but have you seen ways that the gap has gotten better, or in your view, has it?
Well, there's been progress, obviously. If you now have, 3.4 million girls participating at the high school level, and you only had 350,000, 50 years ago, that's progress. But nobody is realizing that the boys' participation opportunities have continued to grow. They're up near 4.6 million opportunities. So what you see happening is boys are continuing to get more benefits, more participation opportunities as women are trying to catch up, and the gap is remaining the same. And over the last 10 years, that gap is increasing. So women are still behind the eight ball, and we're seeing a slowing down to a crawl of equity.
And Lori, I know you are one of the people who are bringing these suits, these Title IX suits. But is that enough? Do you agree with Donna that there needs to be more of an enforcement mechanism?
Absolutely. We're talking about 18 to 22 year old women who have to sue the university they attend that they want to obtain a degree from. And that's the main enforcement mechanism we have right now. I think, Donna's suggestion of penalizing the school, incentivizing compliance would go a long way. I know that there's also been discussion within Congress, bills introduced that would impose a monetary fine, not pull federal funding completely, but impose a significant fine against those universities that are found to be out of compliance for multiple years in a row. It needs to be something on a systemic level. We have to stop enforcing Title IX on an institution-by-institution basis.
All right, we're going to pause right there. On the 50th anniversary, we're discussing Title IX with a focus on women in collegiate sports and exploring how it can be better enforced to live up to its original promise. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Next week, we're going to be looking into what's behind the high rate of inflation we're experiencing right now and how it's impacting all of us. How are you feeling the effect of inflation in your life? Are you a business owner dealing with rising costs or a commuter afraid to fill up the tank? Are you thinking about asking for a raise to keep up? Tell us your story at 617-653-0683. That's 617-653-0683. Today, we're talking about the 50th anniversary of Title IX, with a focus on women in collegiate sports and exploring what it would take for the amendment to live up to its original promise. We're joined by Donna Lopiano, former CEO of the Women's Sports Foundation, and also Lori Bullock, a Title IX attorney, talking about that. Now, one of the arguments against funding women's collegiate sports
is that they don't bring in the kind of revenue that men's teams do. Andrew Zimbalis is an economics professor at Smith College who focuses on sports. He says, for most schools, that argument does not stand up.
We need to understand that these programs, which are male programs, which are being heralded as revenue generators, don't generate net revenue. They generate gross revenue, but when you net it out from the costs, very, very few of them, maybe a half a dozen in any given year, are actually generating a surplus that goes back to the educational budget. In all of the other cases, they're generating deficits in the athletic department that could be $18, $19, $20 million a year. In some cases, in some universities, they're two or three times that amount in deficits. So that should not be an excuse for the lack of development and support for women's sports.
Lori, is that your experience as well? Is that a defense that schools have?
Yes, that's often a defense that schools raise, is that, you know, these are non-revenue sports, and for budgetary reasons, they were eliminated. We saw a lot of that during COVID. The answer to that, though, of course, is that this is about equity. It's not about generating revenue. Right? And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if these women's sports generate revenue or do not. They deserve to be treated the same, given the same opportunities to participate and the same scholarships as the men's sports.
Yeah, Donna, I want to hear your take on that. This Title IX is not an economic policy. It is an anti-discrimination policy.
Oh, absolutely. But I think it really is important to point out there's very little effort on the part of institutions of higher education to make revenue-producing women's sports or men's non-revenue-producing sports revenue-producing. They're putting all their eggs into one basket, developing just men's basketball and men's football programs, and they're disregarding the interest, the public interest in women's basketball. As an administrator, or women's volleyball for that matter, as an administrator, your responsibility is to maximize the revenues, anything you can self-generate, so that the institution has to pay less to support women's athletics. You should do that for all programs, for all of your sport programs. And that just isn't happening. I think at the heart of all this is the fact that even though Title IX resulted in increased opportunities for women to play, it has actually resulted in decreased opportunities for women to run sports. We're looking at 80% of all athletic directors that are men, and most are white men. We're looking at 80% of all coaching jobs in the United States are going to men, mostly white men. And this is homologous reproduction. Those in power are hiring people who look just like them, who they feel comfortable with, who will perpetuate the system that is paying them what they're getting, which are substantial salaries for male football and basketball coaches and male athletic directors, and they don't want to rock that boat.
Mm. And to that point, Lori, does Title IX, when you're talking about proportionality under Title IX, does that include coaches, staff, management?
Absolutely. You know, that includes, as part of Title IX's promise of equal treatment and equal benefits, that includes coaching, that includes staff, that includes medical trainers for the student athletes. All of that is supposed to be equitable and proportionate.
So another common argument against Title IX is that people don't want to watch women play sports. Professor Zimbalis from Smith College says that's not the case either.
But the reality is that there's a lot of evidence that says that what the fans want is good competition. They want good competition amongst well-branded rivals, well-branded teams. Why, for instance, is it the case if what we want to see as fans is just the best athletes in the world? Why do we care about college football? We can say that college football is like minor league football. Why don't we just watch the NFL? Why bother with college football? Same thing with college basketball. We can just watch the NBA if all we care about is watching the best athletes. And because it's what hooks us as fans, there is a great potential for women's sports. The main thing that's lagging is this historical attitude, oh, the men can beat the women in a head-on-head competition, and therefore, why should we watch the women? No, that's not right. The problem the women have suffered is that they're not being, because in part historical prejudice, they're not being properly promoted and marketed.
So, Donna, I want to ask you about that. It seems that this is a sort of twisted chicken and egg thing. If women aren't valued, if women's sports aren't promoted and marketed, like Professor Zimbalist said, if society doesn't value this, then it's very easy for schools to say, oh, well, nobody cares about it. What's the solution there?
What's wrong with your statement, Kimberly, is that society doesn't value this. What we're seeing is schools not promoting because of the prejudice of male athletic directors. So I'll give you an example. I spent 18 years at the University of Texas running a separate women's athletic department. Our women's basketball program sold 8,500 season tickets a year. We're second in the Southwest Conference only to the Arkansas men's team. So we outdrew every single men's basketball program in the conference, and obviously dominated the women. And there was an example of how women running a women's program and selling them with as much passion and exuberance as men have spent selling men's basketball, men's football to the public will produce the same result. And that's what's not happening.
Right. That's what I want to be clear. I wasn't saying that it's not value, but I'm saying that if it's not promoted and raised up in the same way, then you're not going to see that same interest that carries out. Lori, I want to ask you, when it comes to Title IX, things like marketing, promotion, are those a part of the requirements that these schools have?
Yes, publicity is one of the treatment and benefit is often referred to as the laundry list. There's a list of areas that have become the focus of ensuring equity in terms of how the student athletes are treated, and publicity is a big part of that. Unfortunately, as Donna indicated, there is almost no commitment to ensuring that the social media presence is equitable, that the publicity on spending on commercials is equitable. We saw how this can affect, viewership and engagement with the NCAA, Women's March Madness. This year, when they finally spent more money, gave them more airtime, viewership was up significantly.
So talk a little bit, Lori, about the racial gap that is created here, even in schools, that are living up to their Title IX responsibilities, given the fact that the sports that are covered by Title IX are often the sports that are predominantly with players who are whiter and more affluent.
Yeah, and that's an area that often goes underlooked. That, we're talking about gender equity, but in the mix there is the fact that there's racial inequities as well. Oftentimes when schools are looking at cutting a program, they look at cutting the Olympic sports. And for example, Brown University and Clemson University both sought to eliminate their track field and cross country. That's a sport that is cheap for high school students to engage in. They need a pair of shoes and they need to be able to run. And it doesn't require, such as football or basketball, the expensive camps, the expensive club sports that are just not available in a lot of communities where, they're basically, they're trying to meet basic education needs and sport opportunities are, an afterthought at best for a lot of these minorities. And when you start cutting these non-revenue sports, it has a huge impact on students of color who want to participate in college athletics.
Donna, can you talk a little bit about the benefit of participation in sports beyond college. I mean, we know, for example, that it can lead to a very different economic opportunities, not just from playing the sport, but beyond. Talk a little bit about why this is so important for these students to have that opportunity.
Well, it's no accident that 90% of the women in our corporate C-suites today say they were participants in intercollegiate athletics. And so it's really important for us to recognize that what sport gives women that results in these kinds of opportunities is self-confidence, a stronger self-image. They're more likely to pursue these jobs and to realize they can be as competitive as males in getting into the C-suite. And I think that's the most rewarding result of Title IX, to see generations of women who now see no limits to their success. They're not relegated to being mothers or to secretarial jobs or to those jobs that are appropriate for females. They're on an even Steven basis with men, and they're excelling.
Yeah. So, Lori, I want you to tell us a bit about a case that you're litigating out of San Diego State, seeking damages for being, as you allege, out of compliance for several years. Can this case, if you succeed, be a game changer, and how?
We're absolutely hoping it's a game changer. You know, we're bringing, on behalf of the female student athletes, the first ever case, seeking damages for past damages for the college violation, the college's violation of Title IX in terms of athletic financial aid. And, you know, this is upwards of $1 million a year that the women have been cheated out of because of this noncompliance. And, you know, what we have seen throughout the litigation history of Title IX is that when colleges are faced with the prospect of losing money, are faced with the prospect of losing prestige, they will make changes. And so, you know, the hope is that if we are successful in holding the school accountable for the money that it has failed to provide to female student athletes in athletic financial aid, that this will be a catalyst for universities around the country to see that this could really affect their bottom line. And, you know, hopefully money talks in that regard.
Yeah. Donna, what is the role of the NCAA in all of this?
The NCAA has failed in its governance responsibility. On one hand, it has as a principle of the organization that it believes that all institutions should be in compliance with Title IX, but it has no rules to enforce that principle of the organization. It used to have a certification program. It used to require that every 10 years, institutions go through, athletic programs, go through an accreditation program that included Title IX compliance assessment. It unceremoniously eliminated that program in 2011 and has never replaced it. And it eliminated it because it was afraid that all the data that was gathered in those Title IX assessments, that became discoverable by the media if they wanted to see what that data was. It was discoverable if somebody wanted to sue them. All of the members of the NCAA who know they're out of compliance with Title IX are not about to vote in any rule that says you have to be in compliance in order to be a member.
Lori, Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut is introducing a bill that would not only hold the NCAA accountable for Title IX, but also require schools to report their athletic participation numbers to the Department of Education and change the way schools report those numbers, among other things. Do you think that this would help? And is the ball really in Congress's court right now?
The ball is very much in Congress's court. You know, we've seen that the Title IX amendment isn't working unless women, young women, seek to enforce their rights. the, you know, holding the NCAA accountable to Title IX will go a long way to what Donna is talking about in, you know, forcing schools who are members to get into compliance. And NCAA itself is discriminating against these women when, you know, through championships. There's two-phase gender equity report that was done, you know, throughout 2021 demonstrated that the NCAA is just lacking the structure it needs to ensure gender equity. And along with that, reporting those numbers, their actual Title IX numbers, will allow women who are looking at colleges to see how dedicated their university really is to gender equity.
Lori Bullock is a civil rights attorney who is bringing Title IX cases. Lori, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Donna Lopiano is a former CEO of the Women's Sports Foundation and also an All-American softball player and member of the National Sports Hall of Fame. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Kimberly.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.